Probably a few times in your life, someone told you about wanting to have an important talk with someone else, a professor or a boss. That someone came back and told you all they got was rhetoric. So you can tell that rhetoric is not generally held in high esteem. But there's a lot to rhetoric in both history and practice. And we get both in Sam Leith's book, Words Like Loaded Pistols, Rhetoric from Aristotle to Obama. Sam Leith is a British writer and author, currently the literary editor of The Spectator, a British weekly and website. He's also a columnist for The Prospect and The Financial Times and The London Evening Standard, as well as a less frequent contributor to other publications. Words Like Loaded Pistols was published in 2012. The new paperback edition contains some updates. Sam Leith, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
I'm almost afraid to ask, in the midst of this year's flurry of words, what did you update?
Oh, well, I put an introduction in, a new introduction, talking about, because the book was written in 2010, 2011, which was, you know, kind of before, I mean, it started in the, you know, great Obama's kind of honeymoon period, but it didn't yet quite take in the amount of social media that's since exploded up. I mean, you know, Twitter and Facebook and all those things really got going in the time the book was being written. So there was room to talk a little bit about, you know, have they killed rhetoric off? If not, how have they changed it and that sort of thing? So, I was able to go back and try and find a, you know, what's happened in the years since I wrote it.
Was Barack Obama the inspiration for the original version of the book?
He was, I confess. I mean, that may make me, you know, unpopular with those many people with whom he's now very unpopular. But I came at it more or less as a sort of literary scholar, really, rather than a political partisan. And, I mean, I remember, you know, watching him around the time of that presidential campaign, sort of 2007, 2008, and just being sort of knocked out by, here was a guy who very, very obviously and carefully and artfully was using language in quite a highfalutin way. And I found that very interesting to see, and it kind of kicked off a lot of things I'd remembered about, you know, studying rhetoric at university and learning a bit about, you know, how these ancient forms were used. And I'm like, here's a guy doing it right now, and it's working, you know, in the 21st century. And I found that very exciting and very interesting, and it made me think more and more about how, you know, how what was known then, you know, 2,000 years ago applies to what's happening now.
And you do get into some of the responses to Obama, you know, well, those are just pretty words and that sort of thing. So, but Obama aside, the root of the topic, I mean, as I pointed out in the intro, rhetoric is often almost on the edge of a slur. So why don't we go back to its traditional meaning and how that got perverted?
Well, that's what I wanted to say. You know, I mean, now if you hear the word, it's normally, it's got a bad rap. You know, people say this is a person of rhetoric, and it's normally counterposed to action. You know, rhetoric and fine words are one thing, you know, speaking honestly and sincerely is another. And it didn't have that connotation through most of its history. Through most of its history, it meant what I use it to mean, which is, in the fullest sense, it's almost any attempt by one human being to persuade another in words. And in general, that situation is, you know, one person persuading a group of people or a crowd. But, I mean, you know, one of the points I make in the book is that, you know, all the people who are denouncing Obama for his rhetoric and saying, oh, he's all these fancy words, they didn't start campaigning in mime or, you know, interpretive dance. They continued to make speeches. They continued to post, you know, flyers and make campaign ads. And, you know, they used words to make the case against him. And this idea that rhetoric is a bad thing, that knowing how to use words persuasively is somehow dangerous or untrustworthy, goes back right to the beginning of the discipline. But it sort of doesn't really invalidate it, because there's this sort of idea, you know, well, the other guy's using rhetoric, I'm just speaking from the heart.
Right.
And, you know, actually both are different ways of using rhetoric.
That in itself is a rhetorical device, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. I mean, there's an example I use in the book. In Shakespeare's play Julius Caesar, you'll remember there's a, you know, Caesar's been killed, and Mark Antony steps up to make a speech at his funeral. And he says, and he's just come after the speech from Brutus, who was the chief conspirator who killed Caesar. And he comes up and he says, I am no orator, as Brutus is, but as ye know me all, a plain, blunt man. And actually, this is an amazing cheat, because this is in the course of one of the most famous and rhetorically patterned speeches in the history of English literature, in which he wins the crowd right round because he says, "Don't trust Brutus. He's you know a fancy words merchant," and of course, actually, Antony is the fancy words merchant. But you've already got your opponent on the back foot if you're saying to the crowd, you know, what he's saying is persuading you because he's got tricks. What I'm saying is persuading you because I'm speaking the truth. Huh. They're both tricks, you know.
You mentioned that one of the things that's happened between editions of the book is the rise of Facebook and Twitter. How does rhetoric hold on in an age of not only 140 characters in length, but then references to finger size?
Well, exactly. Well, I think, you know, dirty tricks, like, you know, mean jokes, nasty names, you can find all of those in Cicero. All those things work. I mean, what fascinates me about rhetoric is that throughout its history, it has adapted to the means of transmission. It's always about how you reach your audience and how you go over with your audience. You know, go to where the audience is, tell the audience what it wants to hear, make it feel that you're on its side. And so, you know, in the age of, you know, the ancient Greeks, the way that people, you know, used rhetoric was they'd stand up. They didn't have teleprompters or auto cues or television. They wouldn't be using the written word by and large. They'd be standing in a public square speaking to anyone in earshot. And that's changed all the way through. And I think we're coming up to break, so I can rabbit on about that after.
Okay, we'll get on about that in just a moment. The book is called Words Like Loaded Pistols, Rhetoric from Aristotle to Obama. This is a lover of rhetoric, is Sam Leith, and he's convincing us that we should love it too. And he gives some pretty good reasons why, along with a whole lot of history, a couple of millennia, and then a few more beyond that. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with Sam Leith and you in a minute 20. You're back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about rhetoric today, but in a positive sense. Sam Leith, the literary editor of The Spectator in England, loves rhetoric and has now updated his book in paperback. It's called Words Like Loaded Pistols, Rhetoric from Aristotle to Obama, a discussion you can join. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you were taking us way back in time. Ancient Athens, was it? And no teleprompters, no auto cues.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. I was saying that this was, you know, originally people would have to memorize speeches and they'd make quite long speeches, but the people who really were going to get the message of these speeches were only the people who could hear them. And as we develop all these fancy means of transmission, you know, the written word, movable type, then on through, because, you know, rhetoric applies to written words as well, then we moved on to, you know, the internet age, the television age, the radio age, you know, you have found ways of changing the message in order to suit the medium. And so, you know, people maybe 15 years ago, 20 years ago, more than that, started complaining about sound bites. You know, this idea that actually if you're a politician, there's no good making a three-hour speech because people are watching it on rolling news and all they're going to see is a 5 or 10 second clip of the most interesting thing you said. And so the three-hour speech is no longer the unit of transmission. You know, you make that speech because there are people there listening to you, or a shorter one probably, but you know that actually what you're really trying to do is to seed one little quote that's going to make a headline or it's going to go around the world. And that's just ramped up, I think, by, you know, the Twitter age, when messages that are really powerful go viral, and they go viral often because they're pithy and they're short and they're emotive. And I know that the guy, Jonah Peretti, who founded BuzzFeed, I asked him once about how all this stuff works. And he said that they, you know, the things that for him travel are the things that have an emotional content. You know, people react to things that make them angry, that make them, you know, excited, that make them laugh, you know.
So let's come back to your inspiration, because President Obama, because he apparently writes speeches or has them written to be not helpful to short sound bites, which definitely makes him more of a classical rhetorician than most contemporary politicians.
Well, he was doing quite an old-fashioned thing for a while, I think. He certainly had those sound bites. I mean, you know, Yes, We Can was a very powerful sound bite. And, you know, those lines like, you know, we're not red state or blue state, we're the United States. So I think you know, he has those sound bites, but he was, I think, because he was so adept at actually really making a big speech roll up, he, you know, that worked for him. And I think more than it has for most politicians in the, you know, time immediately before or after. And I think there may be a sort of bit of a swing back and forth. You know, there was George W. Bush, who was actually quite effective as an orator, but in quite a sort of down-home, plain way. And then, you know, the American public kind of changed their mind and said, you know, we want a guy who talks in a, you know, an eloquent way and sounds like he really has this command of language. And I think, arguably, you know, the pendulum's swinging back a little bit at the moment. You know, the people who are making the weather are people who are much more plain-spoken and much more kind of aggressive and using short words and channeling a lot of anger rather than sounding kind of completely in command.
Well, I was going to hold this for the last question, but just since you bring it up now, of the three remaining presidential candidates in the United States, what do you make of their rhetorical styles?
Well, I would say that, you know, the one everyone's talking about is Donald Trump, and he, I think, has a very, very effective rhetorical style. It's a sort of anti-rhetorical style, almost. You know, he's got that I'm just speaking from the heart thing going on. And, you know, it's kind of brilliant for the age of social media because you just don't know what he's going to say next. And there's that sense that, you know, he's not being controlled, he's not being groomed, he's not being kind of prepped or you know, manipulated by a team of trained political professionals, which is very, very effective in an age when there's a lot of anger about machine politicians. You know, I think Bernie Sanders had the same kind of quality to him, you know, that's in a completely politically different way, but rhetorically, again, he was saying, I'm an outsider, I'm a plain man, I'm standing up for the little guy, which is part of what Aristotle called the ethos appeal, you know, how you put yourself across. You know, it's not just the use of words, it's the projection of a persona. And I think Hillary struggles because Hillary has that thing that she is seen quintessentially as a kind of machine politician. And so she's vulnerable on that front. But actually, she also can be pretty effective. I mean, she's, you know, even in defeat, she's very effective, you know, keeping smiling and making it sound like really she couldn't be more delighted to be there.
Sam Leith is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book on rhetoric is called Words Like Loaded Pistols. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you mentioned ethos. There's also logos and pathos. So these are the three musketeers of rhetoric.
That's my kind of slightly childish joke on it. But, you know, Aristotle said there was three ways you persuade people: ethos, pathos, and logos. And ethos, which in my account of it is really number one, is the way a speaker connects with the audience. Does the audience think they're trustworthy? Do they think they're sincere? Do they think they're for real? Do they think that they're on the audience's side? Which in politics normally boils down to, does the audience think they're one of them? And that's why, you know, political candidates, particularly when an election's coming up, do a lot of, you know, ordinary Joe stuff. You know, they're having a beer, they're eating a hot dog, they're photographing a baseball cap, they're throwing out the first pitch, you know, they're doing all that stuff. If they're Republican candidates, maybe they're going elk hunting with, you know, some big guns. And logos is the actual formal logical structure of your argument, and that very often comes in, it's important, but it kind of comes in number three, because however, you know, logical your argument may be, if the audience doesn't trust you, you don't get your foot in the door. And the pathos, which I know now normally tends to mean something a bit sad, pathos actually just means any attempt to sway the emotions. And of course, you know, that doesn't just mean sadness, it can mean anger, patriotism, hope and optimism, you know, fear is always important. All of these things are effective. So it's those three, and for my money, Aristotle hasn't really been bettered. You know, those three things are really all you find in varying combinations and various bits of rhetoric.
Is pathos where a lot of speakers get into trouble, Sam, because people feel like they're being manipulated rather than actually spoken to?
Well, I think if you're, with all these things, if the audience feels that there's a palpable design on them, if they feel that they're being manipulated, you've blown it. But if, if you, like, do a theatrical choking up, you know, you're speaking about some you know, maybe a public figure has died, and you make what appears to be a very insincere profession of emotion, you know, people will see, oh, look, he's hamming it up. He doesn't really feel that way. And that's very dangerous because that damages your ethos appeal, because then they think you're not what you're presenting yourself as. You're an insincere person. And I think that's dangerous. So, and also, you know, if you're trying to make someone laugh, which is another important part of pathos.
From your perusal of history, it sounds like negative reactions to rhetoric are almost as old as rhetoric itself.
Oh, God, nearly older. I mean, Plato was the original anti-rhetoric guy, you know, and he was, you know, Plato argued right back, you know, even before Aristotle, he said, rhetoric is dangerous. He said that the problem with rhetoric is that it can make a weak argument strong, and Plato mistrusted, you know, he was really almost a mathematician. He loved logic, and he mistrusted the power of crowds, and he mistrusted the idea of democracy. And, the core of my book is the idea that actually rhetoric goes with democracy. It goes with the idea that argument and public debate is what, you know, is how you run a society and how you decide who's going to be your leader. And Plato really, you know, he was anti-democratic. I don't mean democratic in the sense of the political party. I mean democratic in the sense of the idea that, you know, the rule of the crowd is a good thing. You know, Plato didn't like that. He wanted dictators. So he thought rhetoric was untrustworthy, but it's for just the same reason that I think it's a good thing.
Sam Leith, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Words Like Loaded Pistols, Rhetoric from Aristotle to Obama. You're welcome to join us in the 10 minutes we have left. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Brad in Ashland. Welcome to the Exchange.
Oh, thank you. I've been interested in argumentation, and part of argumentation is to use logic and rhetoric to sway your course. But I have noticed, even though I speak against fallacies, the fallacies are really quite effective. Karl Rove is kind of the modern incarnation of Machiavelli in advising how to use fallacies so effective. And if we want a democracy that is uses rhetoric, it seems the populace has to be somehow tuned in to the devices of rhetoric and what makes for good argumentation and what is shoddy. But right now, the shoddy and the crude and the rude are having sway.
All right. Thanks for the observation, Brad. Appreciate that. Thoughts from Sam?
Well, I agree. I mean, I think, you know, I've sort of got two arguments on this. One of them is that that informal fallacies, straw man, you know, false antithesis, the attempt to, you know, paint your opponent's argument as something it isn't, all these dirty tricks, they're effective. And they are more effective if an audience isn't primed to see through them. So the better we understand how rhetoric works, the better we're able to defend ourselves against those shoddy examples of it.
Well, but, you know, when Brad was talking, it reminded me of some of the things that have happened during the seemingly endless American presidential campaign. I was remembering in particular Carly Fiorina and her description of a video that purported to be of Planned Parenthood. And there's no evidence that video exists, and yet she continued to press the case. So even when confronted with problems with their logic, problems with the factual basis for their arguments, people don't seem to back down.
Well, I think that's got to do with, again, this thing of the means of transmission. You know, in an age of virality, particularly, in which the rebuttal is always less interesting than the original lie, you know, as to use the old phrase, the lie is halfway around the world before the truth has got its boots on. You know, if the lie is grand and sounds good, I mean, I don't want to really get into being politically partisan because I'm not, but do you remember that idea about Obama's death panels?
Yes.
You know, there were never going to be any death panels, but death panels is a pretty sexy, powerful phrase. It goes around the world, it shocks and outrages people, and the, you know, rather bureaucratic reality of what was under discussion, you know, nobody's trying to say, no, there's no such thing as death panels, this, it's going to be like this. People turn off, you know, they remember the slur.
Mm-hmm.
And that's got to do with the way the media works today, you know. And I don't have a thoroughgoing solution to that, I'm afraid.
All right. You do have some great examples through history, though, as you work us through the five major parts: invention, arrangement, style, memory, and delivery. Satan is the first person, creature, anyway, that you give us for an example here. Why him?
Well, I wanted to use Satan in a way to go in and point out, you know, to concede the point that rhetoric works for the good guys as well as for the bad guys, and for the bad guys as well as for the good guys. you know, Satan, the father of lies, you know, he's a figure who, in Milton's Paradise Lost, this wonderful epic poem about the fall of man, Satan is given, you know, all the best lines. And he's given this fantastically, dangerously seductive set of arguments. You know, and actually, you know, Milton grew up in an environment where rhetoric was one third of an education. If you went to a grammar school, you'd learn grammar, logic, and rhetoric. So, you know, he would know that his audience would be cued in to understand and kind of be slightly chilled by how effective, even if fallacious and weaselly and unfair, Satan's arguments were. So sometimes he does have the best tunes.
Okay. How about Cicero? Cicero is the next person you take us to.
I talk about Cicero because Cicero, I think, you know, for many people, he's a sort of the idea of the great classical orator, you know, and the roots of rhetoric are in classical oratory, or in, you know, these guys standing up in the outside and talking to an audience dressed in a bedcloth, you know. And Cicero is fantastic. You know, a lot of his speeches survive. I mean, they don't survive as delivered. They survive as Cicero wrote them down afterwards, so he probably made them sound better. But he, you know, he was one of the fathers of the idea that here was something that we all do naturally. You know, we talk to each other, we try and persuade each other of things, but also that you could improve it by practice, by art. And Cicero was interesting because actually rather like Winston Churchill, who I also mentioned, he started out, you know, with a thin, reedy voice, and he taught himself. He went and trained his voice, and he trained his memory, and he practiced and practiced and practiced, and turned himself into this incredibly effective orator.
Sam Leith is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book on rhetoric, Words Like Loaded Pistols, is now out in paperback. So speaking of Churchill, you seem to give him somewhat lower marks, though, than historians generally give him.
Well, clearly I give him pretty high marks. He was instrumental in winning the Second World War, so there's much to be said for him there. One of the things I found interesting researching him, though, was that, you know, we think of his oratory as all persuasive and wonderful, and it became so, but actually, because he had this very bombastic, very kind of apocalyptic style, for a long time, people sort of slightly laughed at him, because he'd go to the Houses of Parliament, and he'd deliver a speech about, you know, fluctuations in milk prices or the tax on imports, and he'd deliver a rumbling sort of Elizabethan peroration, and people would simply sort of sit and think, you know, this doesn't seem appropriate to the subject matter. And what happened was that almost, you know, like a stop clock being right twice a day, Churchill's great, grandiloquent, rather pompous oratory suddenly found its perfect subject when it really did look like civilization was coming to an end. And, you know, all of a sudden he was exactly what people wanted and needed. And that emphasizes what to me is a really important point about rhetoric, again noted by the ancient Greeks, with the idea of kairos, or timeliness, that when you say something is often as important for its effectiveness as what you say.
Interesting. So in addition to blood, toil, tears, and sweat, he was also railing about how 3 cents is too much for an egg or that sort of thing?
Well, that's an example. But they did, you know, there are contemporary diaries of politicians who would come and say, you know, I came back from the House, you know, everyone listened to Winston and enjoyed his speech and voted against him. Or, yeah.
All right, so I have a question just generally about, you know, we're talking about some of the great speakers in history. Can you think of speakers who had wonderful material built up and then just blew it in delivery?
Well, I can't. Okay, now you put me on the spot. I mean, I think there are people who don't deliver things well. And there are politicians sometimes where if you read their speeches, you'll see that there was really something there. But that they lost against someone who had a more effective style. I mean, right off the top of my head, rats, I can't, I'm sorry.
You're right, it was definitely putting you on the spot.
I've blanked, but I mean, I think through history, think of all the people whose speeches you can't remember. That's those guys.
Okay. So, Sam, when you hear rhetoric, I mean, can you appreciate it on an emotional level ever, or does the analysis part just continue to go on in your head and you're kind of picking it apart as it goes?
Well, I think the thing is, it's possible to make a beautiful, well-made speech that is also, you know, true and morally right and beautiful. So I, you know, in the same way, you know, I'm a student of literature originally, you know, I can read a well-made sonnet and appreciate its craftsmanship, but also be moved by it. And, you know, there are some great, you know, I went through this book from Martin Luther King's great speech. you know, Obama's Yes We Can speech, which I still found very moving. You know, even the Gettysburg Address, you know, you think these are beautifully structured, but they're very, very, they're very moving as well. So, no, I haven't lost my pleasure in it.
Okay. There's some great stuff in here. I mean, the book actually takes us, as Sam points out, from the Springfield of Abraham Lincoln to the Springfield of Homer Simpson. Yes, they do both appear in the book. Words like loaded pistols, rhetoric from Aristotle to Obama. Sam Lath wrote it. It's now in paperback. Sam, thanks for joining us.
Jeff, thank you very much for having me.
All right. Take care.